Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here, and I have to say the hospitality here has been wonderful. I'm particularly thankful of Bruce Epperle and all his crew, and Annabelle Prophet, of course. We have known each other a long time, but we both went to seminary when we were 12, so it really, it would be okay to tell you how many years ago, but I won't. I'm going to be sharing with you a PowerPoint to bring images and sounds as well as my words. I was telling Annabelle that my daughter is a high school biology and chemistry teacher and started teaching 2 or 3 years ago. And before her first year, she was telling me, oh, I'm getting my PowerPoints ready. And I thought, oh dear, I better catch up to my daughter and teach with PowerPoint. And I've actually really enjoyed it. So I hope you will too. I will pause from time to time during the presentation to see if you have any questions, because I love interaction. I have a lot that I want to share with you as well. But if you have a pressing question that you want to ask in the middle, I may pause and call on you, so feel free to do that. Maybe remote won't work as well. One of my favorite fiction writers is Flannery O'Connor, and I start with her words, so I want you to listen to the music for a few minutes. O'Connor, whose stories you may or may not have read, in my part of the world, Atlanta, everybody at least knows of Flannery O'Connor. She had talked about the South as being Christ-haunted, that is, images and sort of memories of Christ are everywhere in billboards and so forth. But there's a way in which the South is also Flannery O'Connor-haunted these days, that her presence is well known. She wrote stories that have been variously described as grotesque, gothic. She saw that the task of the writer was to look around and describe what she saw, the task of the fiction writer. And she was often asked by religious professionals, can't you write something nicer? Can't you write something with a happier ending? And she responded to those complaints several times. But this is one of my favorite quotes, and it's really a basis for the work I do in a lot of ways. Fiction is about everything human, and we are made of dust. And if you scorn getting yourself dusty, then you shouldn't write fiction. It isn't grand enough for you. She was also, even in her exaggerated form, in what might be known as the realist tradition. That is, she wanted to say it like it is and show the hard things of reality. Well, I pick up on O'Connor and argue that theology is about everything human, and we are made of dust. And if you scorn getting yourself dusty, then you shouldn't write theology. It isn't grand enough for you. And by theology, I'll have a couple of definitions here and there, but by theology, I mean the whole enterprise of what we're doing when we talk about how God is or sometimes seems not present in the world. I'm not telling systematic theologians or philosophical theologians what their task is, per se. But I am saying that those of us who work in this ought to get down and dirty. You can see I like those images. Uh, I want to also point to Picasso's statement that art is a lie that makes us realize the truth. Art is a lie that makes us realize the truth. That is, it's often a creation or construction of the artist, but it comes from a depth place in their soul that describes something about reality. And you have in the background of this picture, Guernica, which is Picasso's description of war, which on the one hand is abstract and fragmented and somewhat cubist. So in the sense it's a lie, but it tells what happens in the midst of war. And I'm going to play with that as well, that fiction, novels, short stories are in a sense made up, but they are also coming from a place of depth and help us realize the truth. This is an outline of where I'm going to keep us getting there. I want to say a few preliminary words about fiction and truthfulness and what I mean when I say that. I'm going to then look at fiction and theodicy, the way in which fiction often raises questions about where is God in the midst of suffering. And I'll be looking at a specific novel in doing that. And then I'll be moving to some of the work I've most recently been doing, fiction as what I describe as the destabilization of North American myths. That is, fiction raises questions about those myths. And I'm using here, I know in biblical studies we use the word myth positively. I myself use the word myth positively. But I want to raise the issue of background myths to the American dream and the way in which they impact us and how a lot of novels are actually questioning some of that. So we'll be looking at Toni Morrison, especially Blue Sky. And then finally, fiction and paradoxical faith. And I'll say more about what I mean, that fiction, in my view, opens us up to a paradoxical understanding of both our faith and the God that we have faith in. Just if you're interested, I recently published an article that I'm going to expand. Come Here, Jesus, Wonder What God Had in Mind, Toni Morrison and F. Scott Fitzgerald as narrators of anti-theodicy. It's in the current issue of Religious Education, so if you want to follow up after this. One of the people who has influenced me across her works, but especially in terms of what I'm doing now in this work, Martha Nussbaum, Poetic Justice, The Literary Imagination and Public Life, in that book, Nussbaum argues that novels ought to be read alongside theories that are being taught. She specifically teaches in a law school and a school of economics. She's a philosopher, but she teaches courses at Chicago Law School and School of Economics, and she puts novels alongside the abstract theories that she's teaching. And she's influenced me deeply in terms of the value of fiction for training, shaping, educating, and constructing the moral imagination of leaders. The novel, so different from a guidebook or even an anthropological field report, both of which can be valuable, makes readers participants in the lives of people very different from themselves, and also makes readers critics of the class distinctions that give people similarly constructed an unequal access to flourishing. I really love both the phrase that she uses at the end and what she sees novels as doing. Not all novels, of course, but the novels that she would recommend, and we can talk more about that, but novels can give us an entrance into the life of somebody who is very different than us and who has, on the one hand, our common humanity, but different access to flourishing, unequal access to flourishing. She talks about the literary imagination as a public imagination. And here you'll see her influence. The literary imagination, oops, sorry about that, is an imagination that will steer judges in their judging, legislators in their legislating, policymakers in measuring the quality of life of people near and far. Again, she teaches in a law school. And I add, this is my addition, theologians in their construction of truthful theologies. If we do not cultivate the imagination, she argues, we lose an essential bridge to social justice, this entree into lives of people who are different and have different access to flourishing, helps us expand our understanding of the human condition. Good theology and good fiction, in my view, share some common characteristics. Good fiction is set in a time and place. It tells you where you are, what year, what town, and gives you a sense of context. Good fiction is provisional. It raises good questions, but does not offer absolute answers. This is why I say insight or insight. If you are wondering how I make these links to theology, feel free to ask. They'll be coming up. Good fiction is paradoxical. It tells of an ambiguous world peopled by complex characters. In fact, that's one of the criteria that I would use to choose. It's not always so simple that here's the good guy and here's the bad guy, but you have people who are complicated, making complicated decisions in the midst of a world that is also complex and fallen. And good novels and good theology pays more attention to systemic flaws than to personal and individual flaws, recognizing that some of the people that we might want to identify as bad or the worst sinners are actually part of systems that contribute to that of which we are all culpable. Good fiction is ironic. It's both truthful and provisional. It doesn't promise that it's the truth for all time and all place. It acknowledges that it's a perspective that needs to be taken seriously. And finally, good fiction is revelatory of human situations, expanding our understanding of the human condition. This is a little bit of a disclaimer. On the one hand, I'm going to argue over and over again that I think fiction enlarges the moral imagination. But I'm not going to say, because I don't want to say, that there's a very specific outcome to having one's imagination enlarged. In my view, it's closer to, what I'm arguing is closer to saying that the very fact of knowing multiple stories of multiple people with different access to flourishing enlarges us in important ways. But I don't want to say that you will act in a certain way after you read fiction. So I bring in W.H. Auden, the poet. The primary function of poetry, as of all the arts, is to make us more aware of ourselves and the world around us. I do not know if such increased awareness makes us more moral or more efficient. I hope not. I think it makes us more human. And I'm quite certain it makes us more difficult to deceive, which is why perhaps all totalitarian theories of the state, from Plato's downwards, have deeply mistrusted the arts. They notice and say too much, and the neighbors start talking. So I want to argue that in a sense, reading novels is a kind of moral good, but it's not a particularly produce a particular moral outcome. Now, I said good novels and good theology are located and contextual, and it would be unfair if I didn't locate myself or at least one of the motivators that fuels me. This boy is Friedel Schlosser. He was born in Ahaus, Germany, and he would have been my uncle. He was my mother's brother. He and my mother's other brother and my mother's parents and countless other relatives were killed in concentration camps. Riga is the one that Friedel was killed in. My mother is a Holocaust survivor who was saved by the Kinder transport, but she was the only one of her immediate family who was rescued. So my concern for theology that deals with depth questions, my attraction to literature that raises those questions, does not just drop out of nowhere. It comes from my own background, just like all the work we do comes from our background. So I want to quote Rabbi Greenberg, whose G got cut. Sorry about that. No statement, theological or otherwise, should be made that would not be credible in the presence of burning children. That our theologies have to make sense to those who are on the edges of existence and not those who are at the center of existence. And I also add, no statement theological or otherwise should be made that would not be credible in the belly of the slave ships. I am the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, but I'm also a North American on land that was tilled by slaves. And my father is part Cherokee, so I'm really mixed up and complicated. Don't worry, I won't play it all if you don't like Bruce Springsteen. I also want to speak of the global context, and that's part of what I was referring to a minute ago as well. My husband's church has a partnership with a community in Haiti, and he goes there twice a year. And a 16-year-old boy on one of their trips, a 16-year-old Haitian boy, said to them, "Where is God? God must be American because you are rich." The question being posed, and of course some of the strands in all our theologies have reflected that question, do those who prosper, are they specially rewarded by God? I'm going to just lay my cards on the line and say no. There's many reasons people prosper and many reasons people don't, but that's not the strand of theology that I find the most compelling. That if you are wealthy and successful, it's because God is rewarding you. There are other things going on, including the types of advantages you have had, not to diminish the success, perhaps to spread out reward, but I think that theology is harmful if we ourselves perpetuate it in a world that is crying out for more equality and more justice. I once heard it said that some of us are born on first base, second base, or third base, and those who are born on third base think that they hit a triple. A few words to tell you what I think about some things. I am a professor of religious education. I won't say as much explicitly about how to educate, but I could answer questions about how some of the things that I think should be done, and certainly my presentation will suggest that. religious for me is defined by that which asks depth questions of life. So I'm not presenting to you novels that are explicitly religious. In fact, I tend to stay away from those. I think novels that are helpful for theology are novels that ask depth questions about life, including questions about suffering. Education, for me, is the process of remembering and re-asking questions of a tradition. Less important is passing on the answers. More important is remembering the questions. So when I teach the Bible, for instance, I'm much more interested in what the question is behind this biblical text. Because in that case, the questions are wonderful and rich and complicated. Sometimes the answers and the responses are not so compelling to me. And that's because I believe that the energy of the Bible is in the questions and in the continued asking of the questions, not in solidifying answers. And that's why we have multiple traditions within our one tradition. Finally, theology. And by the way, my views are my own. Nobody else's, not the establishment. Theology is reflection on how God relates or doesn't to these depth questions. And theodicy pertains to the issue of how God is or is not present in suffering and evil. Just a very quick, I'm not going to go over this too much, but my perspective on literature, it's actually also the way I read the Bible. I have been instructed and helped by reader response theory. It's a whole tradition, and there's a lot of different ways in which reader response is understood. There's what I call the impressionistic way, and that's not what I'm talking about. When some people use the language of reader response theory, they're talking about the validity of any impressionistic response to a text. Now, that can be a helpful position in reader response, but the reader response theory that I'll be drawing on is a theory that states that novels or any form of literature does something in the reader. It's an event, it's a happening, it's a relationship between that reader and the text. So the question, and I draw on Stanley Fish, this is his earlier work, the question that he asks is not so much what does this text mean, that is, what do these words put together mean. In fact, he's breaking away from the tradition that focused so much on the meaning of the words. His question, and the question that I'll be using when I read text, is what does this text do in the reader? And part of what I'm arguing is many people who write short stories and novels are driven by questions such as, what's going on? Is there meaning in suffering? Is there hope in the midst of suffering? That's actually something that tends to fuel writers because they don't know what else to do with their questions and agonies. And at the heart of the novels that I'll be bringing to you are these kinds of questions. Two novels that we'll be looking at. The Great Gatsby, which I'm going to argue, is theodicy in metaphor. What this novel does is raises questions of theodicy in the reader. The second novel, The Bluest Eye, The Corrosive Effects of Whiteness, I'm going to be looking at that novel as an example of working on the reader to, actually both these novels do both of, I'm going to focus on Fitzgerald with theodicy and Morrison with destabilizing the American myth of the American dream. But both these novels actually do both of these things. But Morrison takes on whiteness in an interesting way. Okay. Tracy Chapman, for those who don't remember her, Why, raising questions of why. I want to draw on a philosopher as we look at novels and theodicy, Maria Pialara. She has recently argued that of many of the abstract accounts of evil, not one of them presents a satisfying theory of it. And she has argued that storytelling, telling stories about suffering and evil, is a better way to reflect on evil. And what she says is that we should create institutional spaces where we look at, tell, and hear stories of suffering and reflect on them. Each story brings something different and creates an added dimension to our understanding. So I wanted to say that philosophers are actually moving in the direction of looking at stories. Quoting from, we're not going to look at Beloved, but Beloved actually raises the theodicy question when Seth, the pregnant escaped slave, has been savagely beaten by her master, and she's rescued by a mountain girl. When the mountain girl sees Seth's back, and she's 9 months pregnant and has just been beaten, she says, "Come here, Jesus. Wonder what God had in mind." And Seth reflects, "Good question. What did he have in mind?" Okay, look at I want to look at Great Gatsby. Now, why do I argue that this novel about the Roaring Twenties, about lavish displays of wealth, is a novel that raises in us questions of theodicy? Well, in chapter one, we're introduced to the gorgeous mansion of Tom Buchanan, one of the wealthy on the East Coast. And the lush lawns, beautiful curtains, everything's willowing, blowing, growing, green. And it's almost like a virtual tour that Fitzgerald takes us through the beauty. And there is a way in which Fitzgerald did love the beauty and splendor of material things. Are you having so much feedback? Okay. Oh, higher. Oh, okay. We have squirrels in our wall at my house, and so I kept thinking, they must have squirrels in their city. And they make that kind of sound. So anyway, chapter one, Fitzgerald sets up this splendor of this wealthy man's house. And we learn that this wealthy man is exploiting other people. So he is certainly not set up Tom Buchanan as a hero. And Daisy, the love of the main character of Gatsby's life, is described as silver, gleams like silver, proud above the hot struggles of the poor. But then, after we see this in chapter one, we're introduced in chapter two to the other side of the bridge. About halfway between West Egg and New York, the motor road hastily joins the railroad and runs beside it for a quarter of a mile so as to shrink away from a certain desolate area of land. This is a valley of the ashes, a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat into ridges and hills and grotesque gardens, where ashes take the form of houses and chimneys and rising smoke, and finally, with the transcendent effort of men who move dimly and already crumbling through powdery air. Got the beautiful mansions on the one side of the bridge and the valley of the ashes on the other. And in this valley of the ashes, there is this billboard obviously an aged, faded billboard that was put there years ago with huge eyes, an oculist, an eye doctor, and it looks over this billboard with the faded, huge eyes with a pair of enormous yellow spectacles, is looking over the Valley of the Ashes. And Fitzgerald mentions this billboard many times in the novel. What I want to suggest, there comes a point in the novel where George Wilson, a man who lives in this Valley of Ashes, mistakes the billboard for God and says, his wife has been killed, and he says, "You can't fool God." And he looks at the billboard and points to the billboard, saying, "Oh my God, oh my God." What I want to suggest is that Fitzgerald is doing two things. First, he's setting up this gap between the haves and the have-nots, causing the reader to ask questions about this disparity. But he's also got this metaphor in the background of a pale billboard God, subtly causing us to question, where is God in the midst of this disparity? What kind of activity do we understand God? Is God nothing more than a pale billboard? And I say it's a subdominant theme. One of the things literary critics like to do is see things in novels that the novelists themselves didn't know they were doing, but they were clearly doing. And there's lots of things that Fitzgerald seems to be doing. I'm suggesting this is a subdominant theme, that he is raising these kinds of questions. Just like the South is Christ-haunted, the United States is God-haunted. We sort of understand that we are blessed by God and started by God and all these things. And in the midst of this North American sense of destiny, I think Fitzgerald is raising questions about this gap that has emerged. Good old Leonard Cohen. It was actually my oldest son who started listening to Leonard Cohen and introduced me. So I don't feel so dated bringing him to you. Just one more comment about Fitzgerald and The Great Gatsby. This theme I'm going to look at with Bluest Eye as well. But the novel also was written right during the heyday of the rise of the self-made man. There was lots of literature on rags to riches and manuals on how to get there. And the implication seemed to be that for those who worked hard enough, the United States was a place that you could actually take your impoverished beginnings and discipline yourself and raise yourself up. And people like Carnegie and others were doing that and writing manuals about doing that. Of course, we didn't see the underside of what was going on. But this was one of the North American myths during the writing of Great Gatsby. And the character of Gatsby, without saying too much more, is one who tried that. He had been born impoverished, completely reinvented himself from Jim Gatz to Jay Gatsby. But his story is subtly questioning this myth that it can happen smoothly. First, he has to engage in criminal activities to get his wealth. He doesn't quite find a way to do it. And secondly, he, in the end, is destroyed by those whose foothold in wealthy America is stronger than his. So it's an unraveling rather than a reification of the American myth. A theologian who's influenced me, Douglas John Hawley's Canadian. Sometimes I think that he is talking more about the United States than about Canada, but nevertheless, he has been very critical of the way in which the American dream and triumphal theologies have been amalgamated. And he uses that word amalgamated in the United States. That is, we've really taken the American dream and sort of theologized it, and with this sense that faith brings you prosperity. Faith, it's a strand in our tradition, no doubt, way back. But he thinks that the American dream and the American project has amalgamated that. And he wants to pull back and have theology be less certain about answers again and more focused on asking depth questions about human life and looking at those flaws, mistakes, failures, disappointments, which are all part of a depth theology. All right, I want to turn to Toni Morrison, Bluest Eye. And look at her version of the destabilization of the American myth. She has written both in her fiction and her nonfiction. She wrote a literary critique called titled Playing in the Dark. And she describes how the American dream and the North American project became a white project, partly because of the time and those in power, and how the white ascending man who was facing the new world was contrasted and put in opposition to the black savage man. And she, both in her, again, her nonfiction, she directly describes the way in which the American dream was created an opposition between the ascending white male and the black savage or the black slave, but she's also subtly bringing those themes into her novel. And I want to look at The Bluest Eye. The Bluest Eye is narrated by Claudia, who is a 12-year-old girl, and it focuses on Pacola, who we'll get to in a minute, a girl who dreams for blue eyes. But the interesting thing about Claudia is she's very self-conscious in the beginning of the book of the fact that she doesn't buy this whiteness, this claim that beauty is white skin, blue eyes, yellow hair. And she's imbibing it from the culture around her. We'll get to it in a minute. She was given a white baby doll. The novel's set in 1941. She's given a white baby doll, which even in her community was considered the ultimate gift. And instead of being delighted, we'll see, she's almost appalled by it. But she realizes that she hadn't come to the point that she would eventually come to where whiteness and purity and cleanness, all those things that are associated with the white female, she hadn't yet come to that. So she loved playing and getting dirty and having scabby knees at the beginning of the novel. But she knew that there would come a time when she would make this shift to valuing whiteness and purity. And Morrison does a beautiful job of showing how North American girls, white girls, and as a result, black girls also are influenced by this view of the pure, clean person. I also wanted to quote, she's looking at, there are a couple of characters in Bluest Eye, a couple of black characters who try to become as white as they can and the destructive effects on that. And she's looking at Pauline, who in equating physical beauty with virtue stripped her mind, bound it, and collected self-contempt by the heap. And we follow this growing self-contempt as she continues to compare herself to the white standard of. And it's not just beauty, it's purity, it's niceness, it's cleanness. See, I was already predisposed to like this because of my love of mud and messiness. And so we look at this girl who's Pauline's child, who is living a pretty devastating existence, getting it from both sides, from the white world and from her community. And she prays each night for blue eyes, thinking this will bring her the peace and the happiness that she has been hoping for. And the novel repeatedly looks at her prayer for that. Now, again, Claudia is the narrator of this novel. And at the beginning, as I mentioned before, she's given this light-skinned doll. And one of the central metaphors in my understanding of the novel is when she gets this doll, she starts to take it apart. And what Morrison is going to do, the work that she does on the reader, going back to reader response theory, is she's taking apart whiteness. She is subtly but firmly and consistently unraveling and putting before us all that has been associated with whiteness. And you saw from my title what I'm calling the corrosive effects of whiteness. In this quest for purity, in this quest for virtue, life, vitality, color is being bleached out, corroded. One of the most poignant passages in the novel is Morrison's description of the sugar brown Mobile girls. And to me, this is actually one of the most tragic passages in the novel. The sugar brown Mobile girls straighten their hair with Dixie Peach and part it on the side. They go to land-grant colleges, normal schools, and learn how to do the white... Is that me?
No.
Oh, okay. That's the squirrels. Your squirrels have more rhythm than ours. They learn how to do the white man's work with refinement, home economics to prepare his feed, food, teacher education to instruct black children in obedience, music to soothe the weary master. Here they learn how to behave, the careful development of thrift, patience, high morals, and good manners. In short, how to get rid of funkiness, the dreadful funkiness of passion, the funkiness of nature, the funkiness of the wide range of human emotions. Wherever it erupts this funk, they wipe it away. Where it crusts, they dissolve it. Wherever it drips, flowers, or clings, they fight it and fight it until it dies. They fight it all the way to the grave. The laugh that is a little too loud. The enunciation a little too round. A gesture a little too generous. They worry, worry, worry about the edges of their hair. And it's just this long narrative where you just see passion and vitality seeping out of these women. This association, again, between whiteness, purity, neatness, white doilies figure as a symbol. One of the things that I think that Morrison is doing, and I'm going to do this a little quicker than I planned, Louis Gates has written a book, The Signifying Monkey, where he describes the way in which African-American authors signify on each other or have conversations with each other in their novels. It can either be oppositional, where they're subtly critiquing a novel, and Morrison is known for doing that sometimes, or it can be respectful signifying. I'm posing the possibility. Morrison was a literature major. She's taught literature. She read Conrad, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. I want to pose that Morrison is signifying on Joseph Conrad, even though typically it's African-American authors who signify on each other. I think there's intertextuality going on between this novel, and it may be subdominant again. It may be that she's not explicitly signifying on Joseph Conrad, but Joseph Conrad, who wrote about the Heart of Darkness, and even though in that novel he exposed the evil and cruelty of colonialism, he also, in the end, identified the African man with savageness, this concept that keeps coming back, with immaturity, with those things that we don't want to be. So Africa is, for him, the negative association with dark. For me, when I use the image of dark, it's rich and complex. But for Conrad, Heart of Darkness means going into those things that are the negative side of experience. Well, I think, now whether she's signifying on Conrad or not, I think Morrison is talking about the heartlessness of whiteness or the heartlessness of lightness. The lighter one becomes in The Bluest Eye, the more focused on purity one becomes, the deeper into the heart of whiteness that one gets, the farther away from Africa that one gets, the more savage one is to self and other. And I think she traces this through the development of characters who, the closer they try to get to whiteness, the more savage they become to themselves and to others. I'll just make mention, I was going to talk a little bit about, I mentioned Pauline as a woman who represents the heartlessness of moving toward lightness. And so Ped Church. If you know that character, you may want to, I do want to leave a few minutes for questions. You may want to raise, but he's another example of one who was a few generations back born to a white, probably rape, a white man's rape, and the generations tried to become whiter and whiter, and he, in the end, is the one who contributes to the exploitation of Pecola, the one who wanted the blue eyes. He convinces her that he has given her blue eyes, and she becomes captivated in this reality where she believes she has blue eyes. But I'm going to... one more comment, and then I want to say a couple things about paradoxical theology. With regard to the American dream, I think she's signifying on this whole notion of lightness and whiteness. But also, instead of rags to riches, that is the United States or North America as a place where you can raise from lowly beginnings, if you just work hard enough, implication being, if you're not raising in this country, you're not working hard enough. She ends the book with this statement about the soil is bad for certain kinds of flowers. Certain seeds it will not nurture, certain fruit it will not bear. This, again, I think, is in opposition to the claim of the rags-to-riches myth. It's not that some are not working hard enough. It's that the soil cannot even nurture the seed of some and did not nurture the seed. A little more Leonard Cohen.
Thank you.
funny little story. I played this early on in one of my classes last year, Leonard Cohen's Alleluia, and we sort of called ourselves the Community of the Broken Alleluia. Students kept bringing me different cover versions of Alleluia. Jeff Buckley, there was about 10 different versions. Katie Lang, Bob Dylan. I'm a Bob Dylan fan. I didn't even know he had covered this. Anyway, so all through the semester, people were bringing me different versions because they, actually it's because they couldn't stand Leonard Cohen's voice. Brandi Carlile. But it really brought me up to date on Alleluia. A couple comments, and then we should have 10 minutes for questioning at least. As we look at paradoxical faith and theology, some of which I've already anticipated, I want to quote Fitzgerald. I think he was a theologian's friend more than we realize. In his book on the Jazz Age, his collection of essays, where he also talks about his breakdown, he said, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. One should, for example, be able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise." Now we could talk about whether he held it all together and functioned. But I think that's part of the task of theology, is to be able to look in those hopeless places and still understand what hope means, but not to shy away from facing the really tough places in life and the really tough stories. I get my concept of paradoxical faith from Jim Fowler, who taught at Emory before I got there, but whose work has been really important in my understanding. He, in his book, Stages of Faith, he describes a developmental pattern to faith. And you may or may not agree with his understanding of the developmental pattern. I think there's a lot of truth to it, but he, in one of the higher stages of faith, he describes the ability to live with paradox, the ability to bring opposites together, the ability to see that which I identify in my enemy is also a part of me. That's another part of paradoxical faith. I'm going to just say a few things as a concept of what we're after in our work in communities of faith. This notion of paradoxical faith is extremely valuable to me. Especially as we try to prepare people for a world that is full of complexities and opposites and people who need to engage one another. That in this movement toward paradoxical faith, and whether you get there developmentally or some other way, I think there's all sorts of ways of looking at it. It's a reworking of one's past. It's a looking at oneself and the depth layers of existence. It's moving beyond an either-or faith. He uses the language, and others have used it, of the ironic imagination. One can both affirm the truth and the value of the communities one is a part of, while at the same time recognize that others have truth and values in the communities they're a part of. It's not either-or. It's the capacity to say, I stand here and value this, but I recognize that you stand there, and there may be the possibility of those both being truthful. And that's also principled openness. Paradoxical faith is not an anything goes or a flat relativism. It's saying, this is where I'm committed, but I'm also open to seeing what somebody else has to offer my position. The sacrament of defeat is central to paradoxical faith. That is, getting to a point in life where you've had failures that you simply have to integrate. You can't hope for triumph. You just have to integrate them into your life and into your self-understanding. But in understanding this, in fact, I think we should actually use that name and be more aware of how we need to be present for one another in these moments of defeat. But it's a sacrament in the sense of understanding God's presence. And it's a dialogical, paradoxical position in reality. Again, the capacity to affirm oneself and to be open to another. I don't have time to go into this. A doctoral student that I worked with at Claremont School of Theology several years ago did work on Du Bois' understanding of double consciousness. And I have thought, and she has worked more on this, the notion of double consciousness is realizing that one, the African-American has had to live at least a double consciousness. That is, a sense of oneself as African, a sense of oneself as North American. But there's also the double consciousness of affirming one's identity in one's community while also having to live in a society that rejects or deprivilegizes, disadvantages one's identity. But it's an enforced double consciousness that forces a depth and breadth of experience. And what I want to say, and I'm not going to develop it too much, but I think this understanding of paradoxical faith is more than simply a developmental pattern that we can trace and test. And I think that if we look at those who come from disadvantaged positions or positions of multiple identities, we can actually learn something about the depth of faith. Those who've been negotiating, whether it's disadvantage, whether it's just bicultural identities, those experiences which we have considered outside the norm and not taken into account are actually experiences we ought to privilege if we want to look at what this paradoxical faith looks like. Okay.